Good luck.
All right. Well,
good luck, America. Bye-bye.
All of us. Good luck, America. All right. Maybe that's a good tagline. Good luck, America. You know, hey, this world needs a lot of help. And, you know, where we can find the help, it's we are the answers. So as an earlier caller said, let's take a deep breath. Inhale, exhale. Don't be anxious, but organize. This has been More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott. Stay tuned for more programming here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, this is Melissa Lesniak, the creator and host of That Vegan Show. On That Vegan Show, you will hear in-depth guest interviews on vegan-related topics, such as companion animals, environmentalism, social issues, and food and nutrition. We also learn about specific animals, such as possums and rabbits, including their needs and ways to help them. Be sure to tune in to That Vegan Show on the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m., right here on KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is Walt Perezader with the group Chicago, and you're listening to KBOO FM.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Jan Hawkins speaks with Pramila Nadison about her new book, Care, The High Estate of Capitalism. Laurie Mercier's guest, University of San Francisco Professor of Politics and International Studies, Stephen Zunis, has an update on student organizing at Columbia and how Palestinian rights activists are responding to the administration's enlistment of police. Finally, Jan Hawken will rejoin us to talk with producer Mary Beth Brangen about the Sierra Club nuclear-free film series. First up, Old Mole Variety Hour contributor and the director of Atomic Bamboozle, Jan Hocken, talks with Pramila Nadison, professor of anthropology at Barnard College and Columbia University, about her new book, as well as an update on conditions there on campus. Here's Jan Hocken in conversation with Pramila Nadison for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This is Jan Hocken talking today with Pramila Nadison, professor of history at Barnard College at Columbia University. Pramila Nadison has published extensively on the multiple meanings of feminism, alternative labor movements, grassroots community organizing, and visions of social change and movements for social justice. Her books include Household Workers Unite and her new book, Care, the Highest Age of Capitalism, that we will be talking about today. Pramila, welcome to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you so much for having me, Jan.
Well, before discussing the book, can you provide an update on what has happened with protests at Barnard and Columbia since the student occupation of Hamilton Hall in April? What's happened since then?
Yeah. As you know, the police were called on campus for the second time after the occupation of Hind Hall, and there was violent reaction to the student occupation of that building. Students were removed, suspended. There were students who were threatened with eviction from campus. And it was quite a difficult time. Many students were not allowed to graduate with their class. Many of those hearings are still ongoing. There are faculty advisors who are supporting the students. There are legal advisors that are supporting the students. But I think
there was a vote of no confidence in the president.
That is correct.
Passed with a sizable majority.
Absolutely. So there was a vote of no confidence against the Barnard president earlier in April, and there was a more recent vote of no confidence against the Columbia president around the same time, very recent, in mid-May. And so, you know, it's been a very hard time for students, for student activists, for student protesters, for advocates of free speech and freedom of expression. Quite honestly, this is a huge issue for people who believe in academic freedom and freedom of expression, whatever you might feel about Palestine, although this is clearly an example of the Palestine exception. And the university has essentially closed down campus. So there has been a constant presence of NYPD on campus since the arrests on October 30th. And the president of Columbia promised to keep NYPD on campus until graduation. And in fact, since then, we've even seen private security. We've seen essentially a lockdown on campus. Guests are not allowed on campus. It's very difficult to get anyone on. Many of the buildings are locked. So we essentially live in what feels like a police state right now. There were 48 hours when faculty were not even allowed to get on campus. So it's been a very difficult situation for anyone who works on the campus and for students who are obviously trying to take classes and complete their degrees.
I saw online a video of an alternative commencement there that looked like quite a joyous affair amid a lot of the crackdown on students. Can you say a little bit about that alternative commencement?
It was a wonderful gathering. It was organized by faculty and staff. It was called the People's Graduation, held at St. John the Divine on May 16th, the day after the official university commencement. The larger university commencement was canceled. And because many students were not allowed to participate in official graduation proceedings, we organized this and had some wonderful poets and speakers. And I think most importantly, it was a way for us to thank the students, to celebrate the students for their courage, for their persistence, for their commitment to justice over the past 8 months. These students have faced a tremendous amount of hostility and harassment from the university and from outside the university. And so it was a truly celebratory moment and a way for us to thank them and to honor them for the work they've done.
Well, we want to here at KBOO honor them and celebrate them as well today. Congratulations to the graduates, and may they keep that work and carry it into the world. Keep up the work. Yeah. And so let's now turn to your new book. The title is Care, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, which of course is an intriguing title because care and capitalism are by some modes of analysis antithetical. So it seems a bit like an oxymoron. Can you give us the general analysis that you pursue in the book?
So the crux of the argument is that care has become a site of economic profit and is in many ways the engine of the contemporary American economy. There have been increasing financial interests in care. So the Boston Consulting Group, for example, estimates that the worth of the care economy is about $6 trillion and 60% of the GDP. And there are many, many companies that are seeking out ways to profit from care. So there are companies, for example, like Care.com, which is a digital platform company that sold in 2020 for $500 million. United Health Group, a managed care company, earned $17 billion in 2021. And so these companies, the mottos of many of them are doing well by doing good. But because they benefit from hardship, it's not really in their interest to do good. So in the care economy, and you're absolutely right that we often think of it as an oxymoron, but in the care economy, some people's pain translates into other people's profit. So a sizable chunk of the U.S. economy today, I argue, makes money from hardship, from illness, from disability, and from family crisis.
So you also bring a feminist and a class analysis to care work. And here I think part of your book, which is fabulous, by the way, and I think leads us to think intersectionally about an area of feminist scholarship that's been pursued for a very long time, how particularly working class and poor women have a different experience with the in managing the unpaid labor of women. And affluent women that often include feminists who have entered into professions that liberate them to some extent from the unpaid reproductive labor and household labor that women have historically carried. Can you talk some about how this stage of capitalism is related to the women's movement, the large scale entry of married and unmarried women into the labor force since second wave feminism?
Yeah, so the question of care is work that has always been provided in families and households and communities. And it refers to the nurturing, the feeding, the nursing, loving human beings. It is, as Domestic Workers United in New York City says, it's the work that makes all other work possible. It allows us to live day to day. It sustains us, allows us to thrive. And this work has been traditionally done by women throughout history, that household labor, the food service, childcare, education. And so it is often associated with the home environment and associated with comfort and security. And for some people, that evokes a kind of warmth and love. I do want to point out that, of course, we know that this has been exploited labor for mothers and wives as well. And we have to understand that as unpaid labor that has been extracted through this lens of women as mothers and women as nurturers whose place is in the home. The home has always been a site of violence and exploitation. But I think part of what we've seen over the past few decades, as more and more white middle-class women have entered the workforce, is the outsourcing of this labor, hiring domestic workers, hiring cooks, landscape providers, nannies. And so there has been a growing sector of paid domestic work, paid social reproductive labor. And that has created a category of people who are super exploited, who don't have access to benefits, who don't have access to pension programs, who have their own children they're taking care of, but don't really have the ability or the support to take care of them. And so I think what we've seen a care crisis in this country, a care crisis that actually crosses class lines, but so much of how the care crisis is talked about is vis-a-vis middle-class families. The inability of especially white middle-class mothers to juggle employment outside the home and taking care of their children, the shortage of childcare workers available, or the shortage of daycare slots available. And so part of what I'm trying to do is to really broaden our understanding of care, who is cared for, who is not cared for, how do we understand the care crisis? And I think equally importantly, is the private marketplace the primary answer to what we understand as a care crisis?
In the second wave feminism of the 1970s, generated a rich tradition of scholarship, and you come out of that tradition where you're shaped by it or your work is informed by it. But there is one strategy, and we might see it in the case of France, where feminists argued for the socializing of childcare and providing public support for the care of children and daycare services. And then in Germany, where there was a different strategy to provide longer maternal and then later parental leave for after the birth of a child, benefits that would be shocking for many in the US to learn about, who are used to now winning unpaid family leave or very short leave as a radical advance. But in many places in the world, there have been providing care within the social welfare system has been fought for and won for a long time. How do you view these debates? And there's also wages for housework in the 70s, where there was emphasis on commodification of care and recognizing it as unpaid labor that needs to be brought into and recognized in the capitalist economy rather than assuming women just carry that labor out of their own intrinsic orientation to nurture and motherhood. How do you assess some of those differing feminist strategies for recognizing care work within a capitalist economy?
Yeah, and those are great points, Jan. I appreciate you raising that. I think there's multiple ways we could think about addressing care, the care crisis under capitalism. And I think the question of paying people adequately for the work they do in the household, whether those are mothers, grandmothers, or outside workers, is certainly one strategy that is still very much within the capitalist marketplace, within attaching wages to a particular kind of labor. The welfare rights movement, of course, was also very important in these conversations about how poor mothers ought to get public assistance in order to take care of their children, the child allowance, as you mentioned. You know, I think these are important measures to consider and to think about. As you know, we don't have any semblance of a welfare system in this country any longer. Welfare was dismantled in 1996 and turned into block grants to states. States are using that money in all kinds of ways. A lot of it goes to the private sector. I think that in this moment, we have to take into account how care has become a site of profit. And so I think some of the strategies that have been proposed recently are asking for greater public investment in care vis-a-vis tax credits or public assistance, public dollars going to child care centers. I think those are in many ways reinforcing and recreating the care economy. And by the care economy, I mean the profit-oriented care economy in particular. And I think as long as we are working and living within a system that profits from care, we have to think about alternative ways to be able to provide care for people. I think the guaranteed annual income is one possible strategy, one way we can move forward. How can we begin to think about simply not using the state as a go-between, but simply give people the cash they need in order to provide the food, the shelter, and the childcare that families need?
I think part of what's distinctive and I feel important about your book is how you take up the commodification of care work under capitalism and also take up the potential place of care work in a better society and some of the communities and social justice movements that have brought a kind of what we might call a prefigurative approach to care into movement building. Can you speak to that in the context of the protests, encampments and other forms of protest around justice for Palestine, and how you would advise students and other activists to sustain themselves and to bring a kind of broad feminist vision of care into movement building.
Yeah, and I will just say that these were student initiatives. Faculty were not advising, we were supporting students and what they were doing. Okay. So I really want to uphold them and give them credit for the practices that happened in the encampments. The encampment was really a site of collective care and community building. There was donated food and water. There was a healthcare station, blankets and clothes that people could choose from, religious activities for people of all faiths, art making, peer counseling, lectures and classes. And this was all governed by a set of inclusive and restorative community guidelines about respect and support. So the encampment in many ways, I think, embodied the core mission of a free and open university that values cultural and intellectual exchange, but it also became a model of care and community, and one that really contrasted with the police academy that Columbia and Barnard had become. And I will also just say that activists were driven by the humanitarian and political crisis in Palestine, by the devastating and ongoing loss of life with a death toll that mounts day by day. And so I think that the impetus for this was also about care, was about care for people in a different part of the world, about how our tax dollars are going to fund death and destruction, and how the university was profiting from that death and destruction.
So there also are, I think, glimpses we get of how much solidarity it must take, and self-control and ability to manage being under a terrorist attack, constant attacks, to keep these people and communities in some form of survival. Do you get any glimpses of how people are continuing in Gaza to provide care under these horrific conditions?
I have a student who's from Gaza who came last September, and she has done care work there and has taught me a great deal about how to think about the crisis of care in Gaza. And she's actually a part of a larger network of people who are trying to think about what care looks like in a post-war Gaza. And I think it's so important for us to understand this, that this is a moment of crisis and people are struggling. It is very difficult. People are dying, right? This is, in fact, a genocide. But for Gazans and for Palestinians, there has to be a conversation about the future. There has to. There has to be a conversation about what things are going to look like when this crisis is over, when there is a ceasefire. And I think that that's what we have to consider. That's what we have to think about, is not just this moment, but also what the future looks like, and to try to provide support and care and whatever resources are needed to help create a future Palestinian state and a future Palestinian community that has the infrastructure, that has the food, that has the medical systems and the universities. Every university in Gaza, as you know, has been destroyed. But those systems of learning, those systems of culture, those systems of healthcare and care are still necessary.
Is any of that part of the demand students are making there at your university? I know in some universities there are demands for cooperative relationships, bringing students in or providing supports and rebuilding.
Our students and the movement itself is very much focused on that, in understanding this is not just about ending U.S. funding of death and destruction, but about moving forward and providing support. I have a number of students who are doing individual aid. We're donating money. I think, you know, this is something we have to continue to do. The university is not doing anything, of course. And the college where I teach is not doing anything vis-a-vis this. But I think there are plenty of structures in place that we're all involved in that is both about pushing for ceasefire and also for trying to provide the support that we can to ensure that Gazans and Palestinians who are here or who need to get out or who need some material support there have that support.
Well, Pramila Nadison, it's been wonderful having you on the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning. And in closing, where can people find your book?
It's published by Haymarket, so you can go to the Haymarket website and purchase it, or to your local bookstore. Great press. Go to your local bookstore. If you have to do it from an online outlet, go ahead and do that. But yeah, I would encourage you to go to a local bookstore.
Well, thank you so much. And we look forward to having you here on KBOO again as things continue. And we here at KBOO cover areas of Israel's war on Gaza and Palestine in ways that are not covered in certainly our local media. So we look forward to having you as well as others on the show again in the future. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Janice. A pleasure.
That was Jan Hawken talking with Pramila Nadison for the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO Community Radio, and a few notes from George Benson there, too. Up next, Laurie Mercier is speaking with Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, about the new McCarthyism on college campuses and the extraordinary crackdown not only on student protests of the war on Gaza, but against professors who are trying to teach about the context for the October 7 Hamas attacks. Here's Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. He's recognized as one of the country's leading scholars of U.S. Middle East policy and of strategic nonviolent action. Professor Zunis has served as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy and Focus Project of the Institute for Policy Studies, an associate editor of Peace Review, a contributing editor of Tikkun, and author of hundreds of articles and books about Middle Eastern politics, U.S. foreign policy, nuclear nonproliferation, and human rights. He has been a guest of the Old Mole Variety Hour over the years, and we welcome you back to KBOO, Stephen Zunis.
Great to be with you again.
Thanks. Well, you've been following and writing about the new McCarthyism on college campuses and the extraordinary crackdown, not only on student protests of the war on Gaza, but against professors who are trying to teach about the context for the October 7th Hamas attacks. What do you see as frightening developments with this crackdown, especially in light of past campus uprisings against the Vietnam War, Reagan's wars against Central America, and so on?
Well, things really do seem to be a lot more repressive. There hasn't been such a crackdown on free speech on American college campuses since the early days of the anti-war protests in the 1960s. And it's unclear why this is. I mean, obviously, there is special sensitivity around Israel and Palestine, but let's remember that with the cutbacks in both state and federal funding for education, colleges and universities are much more sensitive to corporate donors and wealthy individual donors. And any campaign for corporate responsibility, such as divestment, which is the chief demand of these student protesters, is likely to get a backlash. But I think part of it also is that the challenge is against a Democratic administration. And as a result, a lot of people who are scared about possible Trump victory this November are saying, no, don't criticize Biden. Don't disrupt things. It's going to be like 1968, where the Republicans can say law and order, where a lot of progressive Democrats who oppose the U.S.-backed war will stay home or at least not campaign as enthusiastically. Top it off, we're having a convention in Chicago again for the Democratic Party, where they're expected to have huge anti-war protests. I mean, it's looking like a very difficult situation, for Democratic partisans. So they too are part of this crackdown to label protesters as their most extreme element. I mean, yes, there are a few people who are apologists for Hamas, and that's wrong. There are some genuine anti-Semites, unfortunately, in the mix. But they're a tiny minority. Similarly, 97% of the campus protests have been completely nonviolent. And this is the Guardian newspaper and others have looked at this. And yet they're depicted as violent. I mean, this is things we've seen before, of course, but it seems to be even worse now. And what is particularly troubling is we're seeing that these college presidents are being hauled up before this Republican House committee and grilled, and with insisting that some of the popular slogans and sayings are anti-Semitic, you know, such as saying river to the sea, which simply, for the vast majority of people, talks about a democratic secular state in all of Palestine. That was the original meaning of the phrase back in the 1960s when it was used by secular nationalist groups. But these Republicans, with the support of a majority of Democrats, are going on record saying, no, this is a call to exterminate and ethnically expel Jews from historic Palestine. And so they hauled up these college presidents up and demand they punish students for saying this phrase. And what we've seen is the President Shafiq of Columbia and others saying, yes, we will do this. Or similarly, the term intifada, which simply means shaking off. Of the 20 or so uprisings in the Arab world in the past 40 years that call themselves intifada, well over 90% of them were nonviolent. But you have Shafiq, who's actually a native Arabic speaker, so she should know, agreeing with them that it's somehow an anti-Semitic slogan. And worst of all, when they deliberately misquoted a couple of Columbia faculty claiming they supported the Hamas attack or whatever, instead of saying, no, they never said those things, she went along and agreed with them, saying, yes, we've removed this Professor Massad from the curriculum review committee and this kind of thing for saying things he never said. I mean, it's quite disturbing that the way that these college administrators and others are buckling to this far right wing McCarthyite type of congressional hearings.
One also has to wonder how they get in these positions, because these college presidents have been so inarticulate and unable to just defend basic education and basic principles like free speech. You know, the way they've just so quickly buckled and capitulated to the right-wing congressional hearings. But I also wanted to get back to your point about this comparison to 1968 and how the Democrats, at least to me, seem to be taking the wrong lesson from 1968, because once Hubert Humphrey came out against the Vietnam War, his poll numbers began shooting up. And I don't understand, with so many young people and people of color, principal constituencies of the Democratic Party, how the Democratic Party continues to be here towards these constituencies who are really just outraged about this kind of genocide that's unfolding before us, and refusing to, you know, call Israel to task.
Exactly. You know, Humphrey did come out more strongly against the Vietnam War in the last week or two of the campaign. His poll shot up, but he still fell short, just barely. And it was so frustrating. I'm old enough to remember all that. And Biden doesn't seem to quite get it. I mean, I think it used to be he could go as far to the right on Israel, Palestine as you wanted. It would not hurt you politically. But things have changed. Things have changed dramatically, especially among younger voters. I mean, there's probably no issue besides maybe LGBTQ issues where one's age and one's political attitude is such a straight line as it is on the question of Israel and Palestine. The vast majority, 80% of young people oppose Biden's support for Israel's war. That's a higher percentage than opposed Bush's war on Iraq, Reagan's war in Central America, and even Nixon's war on Vietnam. We've seen when youth turnout is high, Democrats win. When the youth turnout is low, Democrats lose. You know, Biden got well over 60% of the 18 to 30-year-old vote. He's way below that now, and Gaza is the single biggest reason for that. Also, the other key Democratic constituencies, Arab Americans, Muslims, progressives of all ages, other minorities, this is really, really hurting him. Now, I think he just naively thinks that, oh, the prospect of a second Trump presidency is so scary, they'll threaten to not vote Democratic, but when it comes in November, oh, they'll come around anyway. That may be true of some people, but maybe not enough. And this is really what's at stake here. That, I mean, 70% of Democrats, you know, want a ceasefire. 56% of Democrats believe what's going on is a genocide. 68% want to suspend all military aid to Israel. And yet, not only does Biden take the opposite positions on this, but probably three quarters of the Democrats in Congress take the opposite view. I mean, I don't think I've seen any issue where the public opinion between rank and file Democrats and the party is so out of whack. I can't help but think about that 1998 movie Bullworth about the California senator who was being challenged at his black church in LA, you know, about his policies, and he suddenly gets honest saying, oh, you don't contribute as much to my campaign as the insurance industry and all these other industries, and so why should I listen to you? And when people started getting upset, he looked at them and said, what are you going to do, vote Republican? And, you know, this is kind of what we're being faced with right now, is that the Democrats just sort of assume that no matter how far to the right they get, even aiding and abetting genocide, even defending war criminals, even attacking the United Nations, the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, Amnesty International, and, you know, they can do all these right-wing things and just assume that everybody's going to be so scared of the Republicans, they're just going to line up and vote anyway.
Yeah, and as you point out in one of your articles in The Progressive, it's this phenomenal percentage of young people between the ages of 18 and 30 that oppose Biden's and the Democrats' handling of the war. And I find it interesting that you note that this is a much higher generational block than even opponents to Bush's Iraq War and Nixon's Vietnam, that there's never been quite this generational divide. Yeah.
And what's also striking, I should mention, is the majority of young American Jews believe Biden is supporting Netanyahu too much. So this generation gap is also very apparent within the Jewish community, at least as much. Indeed, if you've seen some of the more militant demonstrations and, you know, blocking the bridges, for example, and rail stations and other actions, you know, these have been done by Jewish organizations. This is something that runs really, really, really deep and very powerful. And what's striking, and just to get back to the campus, is just to show the differences, is that I was very much involved as a undergraduate in the late 70s and as a grad student in the 80s in the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement targeting apartheid South Africa. And we set up, in the mid-80s, we set up these things called shanty towns, which were essentially encampments. You know, we were trying to model the desperately poor conditions the black majority in South Africa lived in amid the affluence of the white minority government that ruled them. And the thing is that, you know, when we would take over an administration building or we'd, you know, do something that was clearly illegal, we got arrested as expected. But they usually allow the encampments to stay up. And this time they are breaking them up very early and very violently. I mean, I remember like in Dartmouth, you know, they had their encampment, they allowed to stay up for a full 5 months. They wouldn't let the encampment on Palestine stay up for more than 5 hours. And the crazy thing is, one of my comrades, he was a classmate of mine in the government department, Vince Boudreau at Cornell, you know, he was a leader in the shantytown and divestment campaign. He was arrested 5 times. He was a real militant activist. He's now the president of CCNY, and he's the one who ordered the cops in to come and brutally beat up the people in the peaceful encampment they had on their campus. You know, so it's really quite striking, this difference in attitude when one is calling for Palestinian rights versus those of Black South Africans.
Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Zunis, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco. Well, Stephen, it seems like these crackdowns have almost strengthened the resolve of student protesters and even faculty, such as the strikes that are now erupting on the UC campuses, which are raising greater awareness about not only the moral outrage of young people recoiling from the genocide taking place, but also raising BDS as a realizable strategy. But yet the reactionary resistance is powerful. Mm-hmm. And how will the recent congressional resolution that would codify the working definition of anti-Semitism affect speech on campuses?
Well, that's quite disturbing. The thing was, just like I mentioned about the BDS in South Africa, is that the majority of colleges and universities never divested. But the public awareness that was raised, you know, through these campaigns, you know, trying to connect something that seemed very far away to very local issues, such as college investment policies, were a huge thing in raising overall consciousness and eventually had a direct result in the U.S. finally putting sanctions on South Africa, which is South Africa's biggest trading partner, led the rest of the Western world to join much of the global South that had already been boycotting South Africa. And that was a key issue in leading to a majority rule, forcing the white South African regime to finally free Mandela and negotiate. And so, you know, there's a lot to say for even when oppression is going down. It's just really played a role, I think, in shifting public opinion, especially among people in college campuses who see this stuff going on. And this is why people are so desperate to stop it. And because they saw that the investment on South Africa was successful. And so they use any manner they can, including redefining anti-Semitism to essentially include anti-Zionism, essentially to say that if you put more attention on Israel and other issues, which people may do for all sorts of reasons, they assume it's because it's Jewish and therefore you're doing it because you're an anti-Semite. Or there's a part of it that says if you oppose Jewish self-determination, meaning if you don't think there should be a separate Jewish state, you know, that would make you anti-Semitic. And they could say if you said, you know, Israel and Zionism was racist, to see if you said the idea that there's a colonial settler aspect of Zionism, and that any state based on an ethnic or religious identity has some inherently racist characteristics. Advocating that would be labeled as anti-Semitic. And what's important about being labeled anti-Semitic is that if the Civil Rights Statute, Chapter 6 of the Civil Rights Act, says the United States government can cut funding to any educational institution that tolerates bigoted behavior. So, for example, if there's widespread sexual harassment, sexual abuse at a university, and the university doesn't do anything to crack down on it, or if there were threats against Black students, or people were hanging nooses on trees, or doing that kind of racist kind of thing, and the college administration wasn't doing anything about it, again, the U.S. could cut funds. So that's a strong incentive for colleges and universities to monitor and crack down on this kind of behavior. But now, if this bill passes, it would make it mean that college and university, who allows Students for Justice in Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace, any group that would be considered anti-Zionist or critique Israel in a way that looks at some of the racist or other exclusionary aspects of it, if they don't crack down on that, they'd lose their federal funding. So obviously they would need to crack down and prevent these kinds of protests. So this is a very dangerous attempt to impose this definition of anti-Semitism, which is by this obscure group called the International Holocaust Remembrance Association. I mean, this is just one of several working definitions of anti-Semitism, not the most common one in terms of those of us who've actually studied anti-Semitism as scholars. I mean, most people would say the Jerusalem Declaration or the, I forget the name of the other one, but there are other definitions that are out there that are much more precise. But the bipartisan effort is basically to get this definition. It's not even a definition, actually. It was basically said these are examples of it. And the guy who's the primary author of it says he opposes using it in this manner. And similarly, what's also weird about it is that there's not an official definition of racism or an official definition of sexism or an official definition of Islamophobia in the U.S. law either. Why should there be an official one about anti-Semitism, you know? And so for so many reasons, this is clearly an effort to try to ban, you know, the kind of activism we've been seeing on campuses.
We're raising awareness about Israel's discrimination, racism, segregation, and genocide. Well, this is important stuff to consider, and we really thank you for your work, Stephen Zunis, and thanks so much for joining us today. Listeners can find links to Zunis's recent pieces about the Israel-U.S. war on Gaza and the new McCarthyism on college campuses at StephenZunis.org. And we'll also post links to some of his articles in The Progressive, Truthout, and other publications on the Old Mole website. Thanks again.
Thank you.
That was Lori Mercier for the Old Mall Variety Hour and Stephen Zunis along with the Commodores there as well here on KBOO Community Radio. To close things out this episode, Jan Hocken returns to talk about the Sierra Club nuclear-free film series with producer Mary Beth Brangen, producer and co-director of SOS, the San Onofre Syndrome Nuclear Powers Legacy, presented for free by the nuclear-free team of the Sierra Club Grassroots Network. The film is available to watch as of today, June 3rd, for a week through the 10th of June, with a webinar panel to follow on June 10. Stay tuned for more info, and know that there's a link to the free video on demand from the page for today's episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour at kboo.fm. Here's Jan Hocken talking with Mary Beth Brangen.
This is Jan Hocken talking today with Mary Beth Brangen, producer and co-director, along with James Heddle and Morgan Peterson of SOS, the San Onofre Syndrome, Nuclear Powers Legacy. Mary Beth Brangen is an author, award-winning filmmaker, and environmental organizer. She's the president and co-founder with her partner, Jim Heddle, of the Ecological Options Network, a nonprofit organization that distributes information about democratic choice and the adverse effects of radiation. Mary Beth, welcome to KBOO in the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you for having me, Jan.
Well, congratulations on this award-winning film that is one of the three films selected for the Sierra Club Nuclear-Free Film Series. And it can be watched online this week for free, and we'll hear more about that later. But let's first talk about the film. So, Mary Beth, what is the San Onofre Syndrome at the center of this story?
Well, the San Onofre Syndrome is the festering disease of uncontrollable radioactivity that's being sloppily managed at every nuclear power site across the U.S. and probably most places in the world. These are materials that last millions of years, and they're being stored in containers that may last only 20 to 40 years. And these materials, they're lethal if you stand next to them unprotected.
So San Onofre in Southern California is one symptom of a larger disorder in our approach to energy. Can you say a little bit about how the story unfolds around San Onofre? And I think it was a brilliant approach to organize the syndrome and activism around it in these two phases. You know, syndromes often unfold in phases.
Phase one, phase two.
And I'd like to talk with you about that particular structure of the film. But say a little bit about San Onofre and what the situation is there with the power plant.
San Onofre was leaking in 2012, and we followed the activities and the involvement of five main characters, who took it upon themselves to do something about this. And the two stages were, first of all, getting that leaking plant shut down, and then only to find out, oh my God, now they have to deal with this highly lethal, millions of years lasting radioactive waste that was put right on the beach where it's located in San Clemente. San Onofre is on actually a military site, the Camp Pendleton, it's a Marine base, and the waste is 108 feet from the ocean, on only inches above the water table. So there were two distinct phases, as you said. The first one where people were working around the clock to get it closed down, and then miraculously it was closed down, and then the situation emerged with the waste. So in making the film, it was a challenge because people thought, well, this is actually two films, two separate, completely separate situations. but we thought it best to put them together because we realized that shutdown was only the beginning, and then you have to deal with the waste.
Yeah, and so there's no happy denouement. There was a moment of celebration. Also, part one, I don't think this is a spoiler alert because the devil's in the details about how these things unfold. But there was, I think, a moment in celebrating the closure of the San Onofre plant that recognized the company Edison did not cite the health impacts of the community and all of the organizing around health impact. They just dismissed it as an economic, and it wasn't economical to keep the plant going. And I think that there is a tension in organizing around anti-nuclear education and against nuclear power between the economic arguments, because nuclear power is not an economical way of producing electricity. It's very, very expensive, but there's a long-standing set of health concerns about also how irrational this way of producing energy is from a health and welfare standpoint. So I thought that was a very, there was a tension there in the film around that and drawing out how these companies look at the bottom line and were quite dismissive of all the organizing around the health impacts of nuclear power. And they continued with that in phase two.
Right. And the negotiations to shut it down relied heavily on promising the utility that they would be adequately paid if they were to shut it down. People in that area were thinking, all right, we'll pay, you know, just shut it down, because it happened fairly shortly after Fukushima with the triple meltdown in very similar circumstances, because both in Fukushima and in San Onofre, the plants were, I shouldn't use the word plant, the power station was located in a tsunami and flood zone and surrounded by earthquake faults. And that's what caused the problem. Well, that and lax safety culture in both Fukushima and in San Clemente with Southern California Edison. They had the highest rate of safety incidents reported, higher than anyone else in the country, and also the highest rate of retaliation against those workers that did report safety allegations. So people were frantic about getting it shut down, and they were happy to pay. It's like extortion, you know, we'll pay you to not kill us.
And I thought the film was very effective in both drawing on parallels and the cautionary tales and the lessons not taken from Fukushima, Three Mile Island, and Chernobyl, but that you really focused on just the normal daily operating of nuclear reactors and how even if disasters do not overtake the reactors, there's still irreducible problems, even under the best of conditions.
That's so true. And what we didn't get into the film that I wanted to was every operating reactor is allowed by law to routinely emit radioactive gases and water. And so every reactor has to be located next to a huge body of water that can be used for cooling. And every reactor uses billions of gallons a day of water. And this is just amazing. It's startling to realize. So,
especially with climate change and protection of water becoming more and more urgent, I do want to talk about part two, what I call phase two of the syndrome, of the some kind of derangement syndrome around nuclear power, where people develop a kind of religious belief in this technology and its promises in spite of a history of failed promises. But in part two, you really take up the ethical issues around what to do with this waste. And part two is in some ways more gripping. I mean, it relied very heavily in part one. Okay, the reactors shut down. But now what do we do with all of this waste that lasts for eternity?
Right. It's a real conundrum because the characters in our film were very ethically motivated, but not everyone thinks like that. And the ethics of it would be to try and prevent another place from being contaminated, because this, the original site, is never going to be clean again. And so you're just doubling the contamination. And that doesn't even include the horrendous transportation risks and the risks of leaking radioactivity across the country as you move this stuff, which could happen. And it does happen. It's like moving an X-ray container that you can't turn off. The radioactivity spreads. That's why it's so horrendous a problem to deal with. Everything that comes into contact with it becomes radioactive. So you have to keep it sequestered from the environment.
I think the other side of the what you describe so aptly as the death cult is the death denying aspect of this industry. And I think of capitalism as a system, as a very aggressive system that promotes this idea that you can dominate and control and harness every force of nature, that you don't have to deal with the consequences, just extract as much profit as you can. And I think with these moratoriums on closures that have been promoted in places like Illinois to override some of the previous laws to phase out nuclear and extend the license beyond their normal lifespan. You know, like people, reactors get old and they wear down and the problems mount. And, you know, I think there is this death denying aspect to the industry, the fantasy that you can always control whatever forces you've unleashed and harm them.
That's right. It's an industry dominated by denial, that's for sure. And the acceptance of destruction, not only physical destruction, but of the metals and the piping and the stainless steel that it, they try to put it into, which is a big point that we're making. It shouldn't be put into thin containers that are going to crack within a couple of decades. And we are promoting a method that should be undertaken that the Swiss already use. So it's in existence.
And that's a very expensive process. And these costs are often not tallied when people assess the economic feasibility of
continuing. They're never tallied. No. They're never included. No.
So Mary Beth, before we close, I do want you to say a little bit about the webinar that will be on June 10th after the week, this week, when people can watch the film online through Aventa for free. Tell us about the webinar and then how people can register to watch the film as well as the webinar.
Great. Thank you so much for doing this, Jan. And thank you for your reporting and your documentary on this underreported, incredibly important issue. Okay, so June 10th, we're going to have a panel at 5 p.m. Pacific time with Gordon Edwards, who is the president of the Canadian Center for Nuclear Responsibility, CCNR. And he's a wonderful articulator of the physics of how radioactivity works and why it's so destructive and for how long. And we're also having Diane DiRigo, radioactive waste specialist. She has been responsible for holding back the industry desires to do much more harm. And she has her fingers on the pulse of what other groups across the nation are doing. And then finally, we have Donna Gilmore, founder of San Onofre Safety and one of the experts in our film as well. She was responsible for unearthing all kinds of information that even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who is in charge supposedly of our safety regulations, they didn't know about. And so they've asked her to be a speaker on a couple of different occasions to them. So she'll be on explaining how important thick casts are to enclose this material on every site, despite the horrendous technical challenge and expense that would mean to buy us time to save us from disaster.
So will you be on the webinar panel as well?
Yes. You can go to SanOnofreSyndrome.com, and there's the link then on the front page to get to the free screening and also to register for the webinar.
So once again, to register, listeners go to SanOnofreSyndrome.com.
SanOnofre Syndrome, SYNDROME .com.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour. We look forward to the screening and the panel this week on June 10th that follows from the week of free screenings. Jan Hawken talking with Mary Beth Brangen, producer and co-director of SOS, the San Onofre Syndrome, Nuclear Power's Legacy. Keep up the good work.
Thanks to Jan Hawken and Mary Beth Brangen. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for the 3rd of June, 2024. I'm John Nelson. Thanks also to Lori Mercier and her guest, Stephen Zunis. And again to Jan Hawken and her first guest this morning, Pramila Nadison. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
The month of June is Pride Month, an opportunity to shine a light on the vast heritage of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning